Talk about the uniqueness of Jesus tonight, which is odd because it's now an age of religious pluralism, isn't it? You think about what you hear out in the streets, you hear about discussions in classrooms, on the job, and the word out there now is that Jesus is just one of a whole bunch of people who've come along. That's what the Muslims say, the Muslim people. They'll say, well, sure, Jesus was a prophet, but so are these others, and it ends up with Muhammad. And you talk to the Hindus, the New Age people, sure, Jesus was great, he was a prophet, and so were these other people. And Jesus keeps getting lumped in with everybody else. So then we sit here as Christians and say, well, maybe there's something nuts about us. You know, we think Jesus is special. Well, that's not the case. We're not the only ones that think Jesus is special. So I thought as a way to start tonight, I want to give you about five or six quotes from people who have studied things. They're not even Christians, but they've studied enough. They've looked at the world. They've thought about things. They've come up with some interesting statements about Jesus being unique, even from a non-believer perspective. So I wanted to start with that, and then we're going to talk about eight ways that Jesus really is a unique individual. But here are some people. A few of them you've probably heard of, and some of them you may not. This is an American historian. La Tourette was his name. Lived back in the earlier 1900s. He said, as the centuries pass, the evidence is accumulating that measured by his effect on history, Jesus is the most influential life ever lived on this planet. That's a historian. He got paid to write history, so he knew things. And he looked at the life of Jesus and said, that's the most influential life ever led. Here's a French Oriental linguist. Right, so interesting scholarly background. Whatever may be the surprises of the future, Jesus will never be surpassed. How's that for a statement? It doesn't matter how many millions and billions of people are going to come along. Jesus is it. He's already number one. Here's a Polish-born American writer. Jesus Christ is to me the outstanding personality of all time, all history. Now, I'll end with three that you have heard of, I'm sure. Albert Einstein. I'm a Jew, but I'm enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene. No myth is filled with such life. Now think about what he just said. No myth. You know, think about those famous myths of the past, Odysseus and the fall of Troy and all this stuff. He said none of that matches up to the life of Jesus. So that's quite a statement. Even fiction can't touch what Jesus accomplished. Here's H.G. Wells. Anybody see War of the Worlds, or you read Invisible Man, or what's another? He had another big one, Time Machine. Right? So this is H.G. Wells. He was a science fiction writer, but he's also a really well-known historian. He had the nerve to write a book called History of the World. He took on, you know, every civilization, wrote about it, and he was very well known. Here's what he had to say. I'm not a believer, but I must confess as a historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all history. This is somebody that looked at all histories, not just the Western civilization. He said Jesus is number one. And I'm going to end here with Napoleon. I know men, and I tell you that Jesus Christ is no mere man. Between him and every other person in the world, there's no possible term of comparison. At this hour, millions of men would die for him. So there's somebody that knows power, that knows the grand sweep of history, participated in it, and he says something is very special about Jesus. So we're going to look tonight at eight ways that Jesus is unique. And so you got, I think you got the notes there, right? The outline that was inside your booklet. It's a pretty small print. I hope you're okay with that. I've given you a lot of verses down there. We won't have time to look them all up, so I'm just going to say if you have a chance and you want to just save this, you can take it home and look up some of the things that we won't really have time to talk about tonight. So it's kind of a quick once-over. But here are the eight ways. Let's start off. Number one is something that I spoke about maybe three weeks ago. I came in here and talked about some of the reasons we think the Gospels are reliable. Some of you are here for that. Do you remember? And do you remember what we said? One of the things we said was we have really early evidence of Jesus. Not hundreds of years later that somebody said, well, we're hearing these kind of stories circulating, let's write them down. No, they were writing these things down within 20 years of his life. So we have really early evidence that is unique. Think about other famous religious leaders. Let's take Buddha, right? The Buddha. So when he lived, 500 years went by before anybody wrote down anything. Right? Either things written about him or things he supposedly said, none of it was written down for 500 years. So how's that for a gap? Right? We don't have that kind of gap with Christianity. Let's take Muhammad, a little bit more recent figure in the 600s AD. It's something like 200 years after he died before anybody thought about writing down this stuff. So even there, it's closer, but it's a huge gap compared to Christianity. So we have a lot of early documents. We have a lot, just frankly, a lot of documents. And these are by eyewitnesses, people that walked with him, people that sat with him, people that saw him up close. And so this is unique. We don't find this with any other ancient leader of any religion, right? Nobody's got information written that close to when that person lived. So this is totally unique. Jesus is in a separate category than any of the others we talked about. So I'm going to go past that. We spent some time on it before. I'm really interested in number two. Are you interested in the prophecies? Have you studied some of those? Maybe at Christmas time, they'll take you to a few verses and have you look at things. I'm going to actually take you to a couple of them maybe that you haven't spent much time on. There are something like 330 prophecies in the Old Testament that Jesus fulfilled. I mean, we're not talking about real generalities like someday a great leader will come. You know, it's like, well, anybody could fulfill that. But these are specifics regarding a lot of things that have to be exactly right. So when Jesus comes on the scene, if he fails in any one of these things, what happens to his disciples? Are they going to stick around this guy if he claims to be the Messiah? Why would you stick around? You'd go, well, the Bible says this. You didn't fulfill any of these things. Why would you stick around with him? And yet, people stuck with him. They believed what he said. They died for him because he did fulfill all of these things. So I gave you a list here, and this is just a partial list, and we won't even have time to go over all of these. But look at letter A. If you look back far enough, and I've given you the verses here, we find out where the Messiah is going to come from. He's going to come from a particular group of people, the Jews. Later on, there's a reference to one of the tribes that he's going to come from, so it gets narrowed down. That's the tribe of Judah. Eventually, it gets narrowed down even more. We find out it's from one person's line, that's David. And that's all in the Old Testament. So there's your part of your credentials, right? You show up on the scene, you got your card, you want to talk about yourself as the Messiah. you better be a Jew. You better come from Judah, and you better be able to trace your ancestry back to Jesus. So if you remember in Matthew, they do give a lineage of Jesus, don't they? And they trace him back to Jesus. They had to, right? He had to be part of that lineage, or you just blow him off and say he's not the Messiah. So there's part of the prophecy. I think that's interesting. I want to take you to another one that I think is even more interesting. This is in Daniel 9, and if you have your Bibles, you could turn to that. So we know where he has to come from, but what about the when? This is what Daniel 9 talks about. I'm in Daniel 9:25. It's after Ezekiel. It's after the major prophets, starting the minor prophets here. Know and understand this. Oh, by the way, let me set the scene for Daniel here. Daniel is part of the people who have been hauled off to captivity. Do you know the story of the Jews? They had the land and they lost their land and they were hauled off by the Babylonians. And now they're sitting hundreds of miles away. Daniel's writing this prophecy, so I want you to think about that. They're not even in the land anymore. And Daniel's saying, here's what I see happening through the power that God has given me. All right, so I had to give you that background here. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Remember, Jerusalem's been trashed by the Babylonians. I mean, they just tore it up one side and down the other. They took everything of value, hauled it off to their land. So he says, there's going to be a time frame here. And he starts the time frame, one more time, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until, now who's the anointed one?
Jesus,
right? That's, they would say the Messiah. That's the other frame of talking about the Messiah. Jesus is called the Christ. That's the Greek form for the anointed one. So he says, look, we got a time frame. The clock is ticking. It starts ticking when there's this decree that gets passed. We'll talk about that in a second. The clock starts ticking, and he says, at some point, the Messiah is going to come, and he says, this is what's going to happen. There will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Well, that's kind of maybe mysterious to some of us, but if you have a footnote any place with your Bible, they're going to call these, because it's been used in other places, these apparently are years that Daniel is referring to, a group of 62 times seven, plus seven more sevens, right? So if you add all that up, it's like 69 groups of 7 years, and that's about 480. I'm just rounding it off, something like 480. I'm not a math teacher, so I'll let those of you who love math, you can mess around with your calculator if you want. So the question is this, right? We've got this timeline that says from a decree until the Messiah comes is about 480 years. But we need to know when the decree happened, right? Because it doesn't do us any good. We just kind of slide our time measurement along. We don't know, well, where do we start? Well, we know. Under Artaxerxes, I think was his name, he was a leader of the Persians. He gave an okay, and he actually decreed that Jews could go back, whoever wanted to. Some of them didn't want to go back. They were happy in Babylon. But there's this group under Nehemiah. You heard of him? Got a book in the Bible for him. He and Ezra and some others went back. They were allowed. The king said, it's all right. He passed this decree. I'm going to round it off as about 450 BC when this decree happened. So we know when it happened. Now, let's add those two together. So if we're in BC, 450, so we go up to zero, that'd be 450 years, right? But we said that nines, the 69 sevenths takes us to about 480, right? So we went 450 to get to zero. Now we add another 30 to get to 480. That gets us, how am I doing so far? Are you with me? Am I losing you at all? That gets us to about 30 AD. Gee, do you know anybody who is around doing anything in 30 AD? How about Jesus? Right. So if you want more details on that, you can email me or something. I'll give you all the specifics. Because I sat the other night just to kind of play with it, and I actually, I had too much time on my hand, but I actually worked out the days, and it does. It works out the time of Jesus. So it was not just the case of a few people happy to see Jesus. The entire nation was kind of in an uproar at this time because they knew very well what Daniel had said. They knew when the decree was, and there were a lot of people out looking for the Messiah. And frankly, years later, some Jewish writer said, we missed him. Now, they didn't think Jesus was the Messiah, but they said somehow we missed the Messiah, because they knew what that time frame was. Isn't that amazing? I mean, here it is in Daniel, prophesying it right to the time. In fact, I won't do it, but if you keep reading here, Daniel says, and then the city will be destroyed. Well, if you know your history, do you know what happened after Jesus was died and rose? What happened to Jerusalem? Got trashed by the Romans, right? It's like, our turn. So the Romans come in 70 AD. So Daniel had all that right. He said the city's going to get rebuilt. There'll be this decree. The anointed one will come. And then it says he will get cut off. Doesn't sound like he's going to be a success, right? I'm still in Daniel here. And then it says the city's going to get rebuilt. So Daniel had all this stuff down way before it happened. I mean, to me, this is just mind-boggling stuff. But that's just one, all right? So we know kind of the time period of the Messiah. Let me take you one other spot. This is Micah, one of the minor prophets again, if you just keep going. You don't need to turn there, but because he's not necessarily easy to find. Okay, Micah 5:2. Now, you may have heard this one at Christmas time. So we know where he's going to come from, we know when he's going to come, and we even know the city, don't we? Does this one sound familiar for Christmas? But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will rule, who will be ruler over Israel. Most people stop right there. And they go, isn't that cool? Jesus comes from this little podunk town. Apparently there are two Bethlehems. And so he even gets specific. It's the Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's why he adds that extra name to it. Okay, so that's cool enough. But did you see the next two verses there, or the next part of this verse? What is there about this ruler? It's not just any ruler, because there were a lot of rulers that came and went. But what is there specific about the ruler coming that Micah is talking about? His origins are from old, from ancient times. Does anybody have a footnote on that in your Bible? Because he's really saying something far more interesting than what I just read to you. Do you have a study Bible or any note about that phrase there again about he came from ancient times?
From days of eternity.
Days of eternity, right? Is that different? So what's he saying? There's this person who's going to come out of this little tiny town, and his ancestry is not just Abraham, tribe of Judah, David. His ancestry is what? Eternity. Well, you and I can't say that, right? Where are you from? Eternity. Right? They usually take you away at that time. Right? But there's going to be something different about this person who comes. He's not just a ruler. His lineage, right? It goes shooting way past Abraham back to eternity. So when you read it here about, from days of old or ancient times, you're going, okay, yeah, this is all ancient times. No, this is not ancient. This is eternity past. This is a prophecy. Something's going to be very different about this person who comes. He's going to have some kind of God connection that the rest of humanity doesn't have. Well, I'll skip over a couple of others, but Isaiah 7:14 gets read a lot at Christmas time. Behold, a what will conceive? A virgin will conceive. So there's something very, very unusual about his birth. Then there's a reference in Hosea that he's going to spend part of his childhood in Egypt. Why did Jesus end up having to go to Egypt when he was really young? Do you know the story?
Because Herod was coming
Herod's after him, right? Herod hears there's a new king coming, and Herod goes, what? I'm king. There's just room for one. And so he takes out as many kids as he can, and so they flee. And where do they go? Egypt. Well, it's mentioned in Hosea. And notice none of these things are things that Jesus could have controlled. And it's not like when he's 14 years old, he'll get his hair cut. You know, so he goes, okay, 14, I guess time to get my hair cut so I can pretend to be the Messiah. I mean, all these things are out of his control. When he was, before he was born, while he was born, you know, just a few months old, a couple years old maybe. So there's another bit of prophecy. How about the purpose of his death? Can you go back and pick up one of the major prophets here, Isaiah? This is so powerful. This is Isaiah 53, probably one of the most read and the most beloved chapters in the Old Testament when you think about Jesus. And I don't have the time to read the whole chapter, but this is about this Messiah who's coming. And Isaiah says something pretty interesting about him. Why is he here? What's he supposed to accomplish? Is he just here to be a good example? Is he here to give us wise sayings? Is he here to heal people? I mean, all those things are really great. But look what he says this person is supposed to do when he comes. I'm in Isaiah 53, verse 4. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So was he here to be a good model? Doesn't sound like it. Was he here to give us wise sayings? No, he's not a guru. What is Isaiah saying? He's come to do what?
Suffer.
Yeah, something very terrible is going to happen to this person. He's going to be wounded. He's going to be crushed. All these terrible things. All of our guilt gets laid on him. Right? This is unique. You ever heard of any other prophet, any other famous religious leader, and they say, by your suffering, you will help the whole world. You will get rid of the sins of the whole world. Jesus is unique. Nobody's claim to have done that, right? So Isaiah is laying out, why was he here? What was he trying to do? If you look in Zechariah sometime and Psalm, you're going to find out even the betrayal of Jesus is referred to. Even the amount of money that changes hands, the idea of 30 pieces of silver, that pops up. And what happens to the silver afterwards, what the money gets used for, that's in the Old Testament. And then let me take you one other spot as far as some of these prophecies. If you want to back up to Psalm 22, not 23, everybody knows 23, the Lord is my shepherd one. But look at Psalm 22. The first verse should ring a bell. My God, why have you forsaken me? Where have you heard that before? Jesus quotes this when he's on the cross. So this is Jesus clearly making some kind of connection to the Old Testament here. Why this particular psalm? Well, let me show you some of the things. If you haven't gone through this before, again, I'm going to skim along and just hit a few verses. But see if this sounds familiar, what you know about the death of Jesus. Verse 7, all who see me mock me, they hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, let the Lord rescue him. Does that sound familiar? Right, he's up on the cross, and what's going on in front of him? Mockery, right? Big deal. Let's see you pull off a trick now, Messiah. Right? So that's what he heard when he was up on the cross. Let's go to 14. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. Have you ever heard or you ever seen what happens when somebody's crucified on a cross like this? The entire body weight is pulling down, and apparently the shoulder joints get all wrecked in here. And you have to pull yourself up to breathe, and that helps for a while, but then you sag again under the weight and under the pain and everything. And so you're just ripping not only, you know, the torn skin here, but you're actually ruining joints as you're going through this experience. So there it is. It's in Psalms, right? Psalm 22. Let's continue. About verse 15, my strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. Did Jesus indicate anything like that when he was on the cross? He said, I thirst. Verse 16, I think this is probably the most powerful of the whole psalm. Dogs have surrounded me, a band of evil men has encircled me. And then listen to this part. People can kind of skim over this, but I want you to slow down this one. They have pierced my hands and my feet. And you say, oh, sure, I understand. Jesus was pierced on the cross. Well, here's the deal. David wrote this about 1000 BC. There was no such thing as crucifixion. Right? You didn't put people to death that way. You could do some other horrible things to them, but it's the Romans. Boy, the Romans are really thorough people, right? They know how to put you to death in a seriously ugly way. It was the Romans that came up with crucifixion. So why is it? How is it that David would have made this kind of prophecy pre-crucifixion? He might have said something else, right? They speared me, or they shot an arrow through me, but he says they pierced my hands and my feet. Very specific reference to crucifixion. So is that a little surprising? I mean, it's amazing, right? Psalm 22, buried in the middle of the series of psalms here, connects so closely to the life of Jesus. So you can just go through all of these things and you just keep checking them off. And I only did a few. Jesus keeps meeting all these specific prophecies. Nobody else, no other religious leader ever met anything like this. There are no prophecies that give you places and ways that people meet their death and why they're here and what happens to the people around them, betrayal and stuff like that. Amazing. But let's keep going. How about number three? Of course, the things that he was involved in, the events surrounding his life, are amazing, aren't they? They're the healings. His birth was unusual. The exorcism. He's able to call demons out. The walking on the water. Of course, his resurrection. Of all things, I think I forgot to put that down on the list, right? Oops. Yeah, that was a pretty big deal. So that's my fault. Sorry, it's not down there. You can add that if you want. But some amazing things that happened to him during his life. Here's one that I find really interesting. It's letter C. Jesus accepted worship. They say, well, okay, that's nice. But think about this. We're in a Jewish culture, right? So let's go back in time. So we're right around the time of Jesus. Did they worship anything willy-nilly? Wow. What did the Ten Commandments say? You only worship God, right? You don't worship anybody else, anything else. Angels come along, they tell you, don't get down on your knees for me, right? You don't worship me. And Jesus accepted worship. He didn't say, oh, come on, you guys. Oh, you're embarrassing me. Let's stop it here. He doesn't do that. He just lets them worship him. That's what you did for God. Amazing. And he accepted it. Right? He didn't say, let's knock it off here. So we may go past that when we read it, but that's amazing. There's no other prophet from any other religion that accepts that kind of worship. Let's go to number four. Some of the things that he said were amazing. Let's start with this. Jesus would walk up to a group and he'd say, you have heard it said, but I tell you. Do you know where I'm going with that? Have you seen that in Matthew and Mark and Luke and John? He would constantly start a teaching by saying, you have heard it said. Well, it was the rabbis, right? The rabbis over centuries had taken the Ten Commandments and the other laws and the Torah, and they said, this is what it means. And they had worked endlessly to get, kind of flesh it out so the Jews would understand, what does it mean to keep the Sabbath holy? The rabbis would say, this is what it means. You can only walk this far. You can only do this. This is what it means. The Jews go, okay. So pretty soon there's all these laws that are kind of added to the Ten Commandments. You got them all. So Jesus comes along and he says, you can throw all that out. I'll tell you what's real. Can you imagine? I mean, this is, again, a very different culture, but can you imagine you're a Jew? You've been raised in the idea the rabbis know best. They've got this collected wisdom of hundreds of years. And then this guy walks in and he says, nah, you can throw all that out. I'll tell you. What? You're better? You're way beyond the rabbis? Yeah, pretty much. And he went ahead and he told him the thing. This is what it really means. And of course, didn't go over big with the Pharisees, right? They're not happy with that. How about some of the claims that he made about himself? I made a list, and I was just going to share that with you. So can you imagine next Wednesday, you come here, and Rob says, I got somebody that wants to speak to you for a few minutes. You don't recognize him. You go, okay. So you sit down, you get comfortable, and he walks up and he says things like this to you. I shall lose none of all that God has given me, but raise them up at the last day. Later on, whoever drinks the water I give him will never thirst. So now you're starting to look at each other maybe at this point. I'm the bread of life. If anyone eats this bread, he will live forever. Before Abraham was born, I am. I'm the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I'm the resurrection and the life. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Are you getting a little nervous if you hear somebody talk like that? I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I mean, you would never hear anybody else say things like this, would you? This is crazy talk unless you knew this person and knew enough about him. But how's that for that kind of claiming of power over death and what he can do for you after death. I mean, just amazing talk here coming out of the mouth of Jesus. So the things he says are just wild stuff. He forgave sins. That didn't go over very big. Right? Remember some of those things? They bring a guy to Jesus, paralytic or something. He said, your sins are forgiven. Everybody's going, wait a minute. Only God can do that. What are you talking about? Jesus said that. Your sins are forgiven. How about some of the promises he made? I'm just going to give you one here. It's in Matthew. You don't need to turn to that. It's the very last part of Matthew. In fact, it's the last phrase of Matthew. Jesus says, surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. You think Muhammad ever said that? Hey, don't worry, guys. I'll die, but I'll be with you till the end of the ages. I don't think so. Buddha, Confucius, Moses, Zoroaster. Right? Nobody made that kind of claim. So is Jesus just one more prophet? I mean, that's an amazing claim right there. Well, that's one thing, right? What he said about himself. But let me go to the next section here. What about what his friends said, the people that were eyewitnesses that hung around him? Do you remember what Thomas said? It's in the end, toward the end of John. Thomas wasn't there when Jesus first appeared. You remember that? And finally, Jesus shows up, and Thomas says, I don't know. I'd have to really see those injuries, you know, make sure it was really him. So he walks up to Thomas, and he says, look, Thomas, anybody know what the reaction of Thomas was? What does he say? My Lord and my God. I mean, again, would a Jew say that? No. Something was so different about Jesus. He was willing, a friend who had seen him, was willing to call him God. And you still get people today that say, you know, Jesus wasn't God. I don't get it. I mean, you might as well, you'd have to throw out the whole New Testament. Thomas thought he was, and he said so. Let me take you one other place. John 1, the very beginning of the book of John. Here's a person who was close to Jesus. He hung out with him a lot. He was called the beloved disciple. And look what he does. Instead of the kind of genealogy that we got in Matthew that takes it back to David and eventually back to Abraham, where does he take Jesus at the beginning? He says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Oh. So where's his beginning? Not so much earth. We're back into eternity again, right? So here's a guy that hung out with Jesus, and he says, this is a person from eternity. Later on, and he has those little short letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. I'm just going to read you a phrase in there. Here's another comment about him, 1 John 2:2. Here's what he had to say about Jesus. Here we go. Jesus Christ, he says, the righteous one, he is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for ours, but also for the sins of the whole world. Right? So this is not just a Jewish thing. This person is so powerful. He's got so much power, he can take away the sins of the entire world. Wow. Anything like that happened with Muhammad? Zoroaster, Moses, Lao Tzu? I mean, go on and on. They're all the religious leaders. Nobody's had any claim like that given to them. How about Peter? Peter spent a lot of time with him. Here's what Peter had to say. Again, just one short reference, 1 Peter 3, 21 and 22. I'm trying to give you different angles, different things that they said about him. He says, talks about Jesus Christ in verse 22, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. He's in charge. Okay, there's not a single Muslim today that says Muhammad is sitting at the right hand of God in charge of angels. Not Buddha, not Confucius. Right? This is an amazing claim by somebody who hung out with Jesus. So his friends said he was a completely different kind of person than anybody they'd ever met before. You know, even his enemies, I'm on number 6 here, even what his enemies said, those statements are unique too. Let's take the Jews that put him to death. Why did they put him to death? Not for claiming to be the Messiah. That was okay. They said to him, are you the Son of God? And Jesus said, yes. They tear their robes and they said, that's enough. What was the label? What'd they give that term, do you know? That's blasphemy, right? So why are they getting Jesus? Why are they angry at Jesus? Not for claiming to be the Messiah, for claiming to be God. So even the enemies, even though they didn't buy into it, I mean, do you see, they recognized what Jesus was saying, and they said, that's why we're going to put him to death. He's claiming to be God. That's blasphemy, right? There's only one God. They didn't picture this Trinity business. Later on, the Jews kept notes about their Torah and their law, and they had all these rabbinical notes. Do you know they actually made comments about Jesus after his death? Like 100, 200 years later? And they had to figure out, so what do we say about this guy? And so they claimed that he did miraculous things, but it was because of sorcery. But isn't that interesting? They actually had to admit. They didn't say, oh, he was a guy who just claimed a lot of stuff and a bunch of wild, you know, comments went around, but he didn't really do anything. They said, yeah, he did miracles, but it was sorcery, right? It was black arts. Well, I just think that's interesting that they would actually mention Jesus as a miracle worker, but just attributing it to the dark side rather than the good side. During the same time, you had Roman historians. So they mentioned Jesus, right? They were not friends, but they do mention Jesus. They were hostile, but they said he got worshipped. Well, isn't that interesting? People today say that it was a power play by the church hundreds of years later to come up with this idea of Jesus being divine. The Romans, during the time period of the disciples, said, this crazy Christian group is worshiping this Jesus. So part of him claiming to be God and the church accepting him to be God, it was from the very beginning. It wasn't something that came across 300 years later because of the Emperor Constantine. No, it was going on right then. The best Roman historians were claiming, yeah, this guy is being worshipped. It didn't mean they bought into it, but they did recognize that. So we've even got the enemies making some amazing statements about Jesus. And then number seven, I just made a big old list. I won't take the time to go through it, but there isn't any religious leader who has made this kind of a positive impact in the world today. Everything from the way women's status was elevated to the starts of hospitals in his name, democracy, science. Don't let anybody tell you that Christianity and science are at loggerheads and fight. That's kind of the message of the day. Are you guys hearing any of that? You know, that, well, religion, you know, that's okay, but every time they're in power, they destroy science. Science is the way to go, and we have to get away from religious influence because it hurts us. That's not true. Modern science came out of Christianity. Okay, so that's something, just lock that away somewhere, that it's an absolute lie. Even non-Christians who really understand, they'll agree with you. So you can make that statement in a class, any place, and if people know what they're talking about, they'll understand. Christianity produced modern science. It wasn't a hindrance. It produced modern science. So I've just given you a big old list there of other things that we can thank the founder of the faith, Jesus, for producing among his followers later on. Democracy, rights of the individual, the elevation of the common man. I mean, just a lot of good things. So the last item, here's another thing that makes Jesus unique, is he's very different in relationship to his religion than other founders were, their faith. So let's take Muhammad. Could you take Muhammad out of Islam? Would you still have Islam today? You would, wouldn't you? I mean, they have certain things they have to do. You know, they have to give alms, and they should go on a pilgrimage, and they should pray so many times a day. You don't need Muhammad for that. Right, he just got the ball rolling, he's gone, now you can keep being a Muslim today. Now, yeah, they honor him, but I'm just saying you don't need him in that faith. It works perfectly well without him. How about Buddhism? Does it need Buddha? No, it's just four things you're supposed to keep track of, and then there's an eightfold path that you're supposed to follow. It's strictly a bunch of do's and don'ts. You don't need him. And you can go down the list of every religious leader. You don't need that person. Mary Baker Eddy started Christian Science. You don't need her. What's his name? L. Ron Hubbard started Scientology. You don't need him. Brigham Young, Joseph Smith. Do you need them to have Mormonism today? No. But what happens if you pull Jesus out of Christianity? What's left? I don't know. The golden rule? Be nice? I mean, he is the religion, isn't he? That's why Christians talk about not a religion, it's a relationship. That's exactly right, because he's the only religious leader you need. You don't need Muhammad. You don't need Buddha. You could still be a Buddhist. You could still be a Muslim. You have to have Jesus in the picture here, or it doesn't work. So here's my conclusion. It seems to me we can go one of four ways when it comes to the life of Jesus. He said such amazing things. Other people said some amazing things about him. I think we're left with one of these four ideas. Jesus is either liar, Lord, legend, or lunatic. Okay, let's try three of those. Start off with he might be a liar, right? These things that he said, maybe he knew that wasn't true, but he just claimed them. But do you see any problem with that?
Miracles. How could a liar do miracles?
Yeah, how's he doing these things that he does? Why would God honor him? What else? What's that?
He was showing a long way with his life. He went to crucifixion.
Yeah, I mean, the life that he led. How about all the people that stayed loyal to him? Would you stay loyal to a person who lied about things like that? I'm God, I'll save you the rest of your life. And you go, no, I don't think so. You know, I've caught him in a bunch of lies. You don't get away with lies your whole life. All right, well, maybe not a liar. What about a lunatic? He said it, but he thought it was true, but it wasn't true. That makes you a lunatic. Right, like thinking you're Napoleon. Okay, don't you have the same problems there? Who's going to hang around a lunatic? Right, who's going to go die for a lunatic? That doesn't make any sense. Third possibility, he's a legend. In other words, he was just a nice guy, but later on, people wrote neat stories about him. They changed him into a super wonder worker. What's the problem with that one? The stories about Jesus are so close to his time period, there's no time for legend to get started. The stories are circulating 10 to 20 years after Jesus' life. If you say Jesus rose from the dead, and you say it in the city that he died, within 10 years, you've got eyewitnesses who could boo you and tell you you're wrong. I saw him, he was dead, and he never came back. Right? But the faith starts in Jerusalem by people who said things or outrageous for the time, but nobody could refute it because those things had happened. So the religion gets started right there and explodes. So let's eliminate those, right? So we got legend out, liar, lunatic. I think we're left with him as Lord. And I hope you feel the same way, especially now in the Easter season here. So thanks very much.